We're talking about at-home genetic testing kits and privacy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. More than 26 million people have taken at-home ancestry tests, and MIT Technology Review did a forecast last year and found at this pace, the four leading commercial ancestry and health databases could amass data on the genetic makeup of more than 100 million people by early next year. Have you done at-home genetic testing? Why did you do it? What did the results say? Were you satisfied? What do you wonder about privacy? We're at 800-642-1234 through the hour. Audrey Gash is a genetics professor and interim director of the Center for Genomic Science Innovation at UW-Madison. Audrey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we also have Jillian Slate, is a legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. Her report issued this month is called Genetic Privacy in the Age of Commercial DNA Testing. Jill, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, let's start with your publication, your report. What were you driving at? What were you trying to get at?
I got interested in this topic because I'm generally interested in digital and technological literacy. So how much people know or understand about a particular technology before or even during using it. And that issue kind of came to the fore in the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which revealed just how much people were unaware of how information they post on Facebook and other social media platforms might be used by third parties. So part of the goal of this publication was to introduce legislators and the public to some of the concerns around commercial genetic testing, some of the current uses of the genetic information that people provide to these services, and some efforts to regulate this industry, both on the federal level and in different states.
There's a lot there that we're going to be able to unpack this hour. But as a whole, do you find that we know enough right now about the implications of these at-home genetic tests?
I'd say we're learning more every day, and that comes with more attention to the industry, particularly how the industry has reshaped law enforcement use of genetic information, but also how it's changed scientific research and particularly pharmaceutical research.
Scientific research. Audrey, you know, you are a genetics professor. What do you find fascinating right now about at-home genetic testing and also the contents of this report?
I find it fascinating how many people are interested in learning this information about themselves. As a scientist, I think it's great that people are engaged and interested in learning about that. But I also recognize that it's challenging to understand the data. It's challenging even for scientists and clinicians to fully interpret the data. And so I think discussions like these are great because it both helps the public understand what we can and can't do with the genetic data. And it also helps analysts and policymakers think about how we can protect ourselves by thinking ahead and establishing the correct rules. In terms of the science, it's a really exciting time for genomics and understanding DNA sequences. There's a lot scientists have figured out about how to read a DNA sequence and interpret genetic information, but there's a lot still that we don't understand and are trying to figure out. And I'll add that having genetic data from large sets of individuals is really helping scientists figure out how to interpret the genome. So that also is an added level of complexity. There are benefits to science and medicine in sharing data.
These open source large databases.
Well, not necessarily open source databases, okay. but more what I mean is enabling scientists to have access to genetic data and information so that we can study it and understand it better. That's not to say that open source sharing genomic data with the world is the route in that direction, but just that it is powerful. There are power in numbers in having this data if used in the right way.
Sorry to jump in, but one of the issues that one of the central issues that you spoke to that we're addressing in the report is how to balance scientific progress and public safety with those concerns for individual privacy. So how to make sure that the industry is not regulated so much that there's a chilling effect on scientific research and all the progress
on the scientific breakthroughs. Yeah. Talking with Jill Slate, a legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau, she wrote a report called Genetic Privacy in the Age of Commercial DNA Testing. We have Audrey Gash here as well, a genetics professor at UW-Madison. What do you think of these at-home tests? Are you opposed to taking one? What concerns you? Have family members taken a DNA genetic test? Are you concerned your information is on these health databases? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jill, let's spend some time here on laws, regulation. How do federal laws regulate the industry as we know it right now around these at-home genetic kits?
The industry is largely self-regulating, although there are some federal protections against genetic discrimination under the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which was passed in 2008 and bolstered by the Affordable Care Act. Under that legislation, it's illegal to discriminate. Health insurers are prohibited from refusing coverage or changing rates based on something indicated in a genetic test. So, for example, a health insurer would be prohibited from refusing coverage based on a gene that might indicate predisposition to Alzheimer's or colorectal cancer. That act also prohibits discrimination in employment, and a lot of state laws mirror those protections. But there are also areas where those non-discrimination prohibitions are not applied. Beyond that, the FDA does regulate some marketing claims of commercial genetic testing companies. So those companies have to request approval to provide results related to a specific medical condition. And 23andMe has successfully done that and gradually increased the number of health-related results that they can provide. That said, marketing claims outside of health are largely unregulated. Journalists have drawn attention to the fact that some non-health-related claims are so vague or specious as to be meaningless, with one journalist I read quite amusingly submitted his dog's saliva to a bunch of different companies to see what they would
come up with.
Mm-hmm. And a bunch of them, to their credit, said that the DNA was not identifiable as human. But one, which was a company that purports to provide information about your potential athletic prowess, simply replied with results that seemed like a really athletic person and with no indication that it came from a dog. So those claims are not very well regulated.
We're talking about at-home DNA testing kits. What happens with your data with third parties? We have UW-Madison genetics professor Audrey Gash. We have Jill Slate, who is a legislative analyst at the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. What questions do you have over privacy and genetic testing kits? What do you want to know about federal legislation, federal laws? Have you debated taking a test? What did you want to find out? Join in through the hour, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in a moment with Jill Slate and Audrey Gash right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about at-home genetic tests like 23andMe and Ancestry DNA and genetic laws around them. Medical and legal experts warn that taking a DNA test is like opening a Pandora's box, if you will. Once you take the test, there's no way to forget the information and the results. And testing companies, they're not completely regulated in terms of what they can and can't do with genetic data. Are you an attorney? What should people know about their rights after doing the at-home kit? Are you in the medical profession? Have you talked with your patients about these kits? What do you say? Be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We're talking with Jill Slate. She's a legislative analyst at the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau, and she just authored a report on genetic privacy. We also have Audrey Gash, and she's a genetics professor at UW-Madison. Let's go to the phones now. Keldy is joining us from Washburn this morning. Hi, Keldy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, it was more of a maybe a little story, and I did two of the genetic testing companies for a very personal reason. I was looking for my birth family, and I did pause. I thought long and hard before doing that, but I was adopted out of a closed record state that I think ironically just opened to adoptees the ability to find their own, to get their pre-adoption birth certificate today. Yeah. And that's New York. And so I did two tests to double my odds, and I did find my birth family.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was fantastic. I got the fairy tale ending. Not everybody does, but that was a big consideration to think about. Okay, so now all of that information is out there, but it's on the flip side, I wasn't legally allowed to find out my medical information. There is cancer in the family that's concerning. So what, you know, why were my rights, in a sense, squashed, and why did I have to go to a private company
to find this information?
Out?
Yeah.
Right. Right. So that was just some thoughts.
Keldy, thank you so much for sharing your story. Audrey, you know, Keldy says she had this fairy tale ending, and yet that came with some trade-offs, some consequences.
Right. Yeah, this is one of the concerns with genetic testing, both for these direct-to-consumer situations, but also even in the clinics. Many medical doctors now are using genetic tests for their patients. And a major challenge that we think about is when patients and customers get information that they weren't expecting. So I'm very glad for the caller that that worked out well for her. It is not uncommon for patients and customers to find out that they may have a genetic predisposition for a disease that they were not expecting at all. And that's sometimes difficult for people to deal with emotionally. It is sadly not too uncommon that people find out that their parents are not who they think they are, their genetic parents. And so this is something that clinicians certainly think about. How do you deliver that information to patients? So there are other risks that that people should understand when they take these tests.
And when you take the test at home, you don't maybe have that clinician around you to help you interpret what you are seeing in front of your screen.
That's exactly correct. And I think for many of us who are in the science and medical field, that is a bit of a concern, at least for me personally, is that customers don't have a geneticist, a genetic counselor with them to interpret the data. Now, companies like 23andMe do their best to try to provide that information or at least access to somebody who can support the customers. There are a lot of consent and information forms that customers are supposed to be reading when they submit their samples. Some of that is on how to understand the data. Not everybody reads that, and not everybody understands. It's very complicated information. And so I always recommend to people, if they have do these tests and get results that are concerning to them, they should contact their family physician and find a genetic counselor. Even family physicians often don't have the training in this day and age to really fully understand or interpret the data. Genetic counselors are trained to do that.
We're talking with Audrey Gash. She's a genetics professor at UW-Madison. Jill Slate here as well, legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. We're looking at the laws, the medicine around at-home genetic tests. You can join in. Are you someone who works in law enforcement? How do you use DNA databases? What should the public know? What questions do you have over privacy and these at-home genetic testing kits? What do you know? Want to know about federal and state laws? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jill, how do these companies store our DNA information and ensure anonymity?
For the most part, these companies' privacy statements lay out how they de-identify or anonymize data. So when you send in a spit sample to the company, they will, along with your results about ancestry, background, biological relatives, provide a machine-readable data file that basically describes your DNA in a text format. And when that's also the information that goes to third parties like scientific researchers. When it goes to third parties, it's stripped of any identifiable material. So your name, your address, the credit card you used to purchase the kit, so that scientists can use that information and draw conclusions from it without your name being associated with it.
Oh, so it's like a true John or Jane Doe.
Yes, though researchers have shown how it's possible in some instances to re-identify information. So there is some concern that someone could be traced back. There's no federal law that requires certain standards of de-identification to be met, and that's something that experts who study this issue have suggested, there being standards of de-identification so that they're absolutely sure your DNA can't be traced back to your name, and also standards of encryption so that if hackers were to breach the security systems of a company like Ancestry DNA, that your DNA, which is a form of permanent and inalterable personal information, wouldn't be out there and exposed.
Audrey, based on the research that you do in genetics, how do we know if the information we're given in these results are very accurate and true?
That's an interesting question. And I think that part of the challenge is that we scientists don't fully understand how to interpret the meaning of DNA differences. And so we're coming a long way. There are some, so maybe I should just explain for your readers, the vast majority of our DNA from one person to the next is the same. But there's a fraction of a percent of the sequence differences in our DNA that are different from person to person. A lot of those differences are meaningless to our health or to our traits, but they're useful for tracing ancestry. A portion of those DNA differences from person to person have an impact to our trait or traits to our health. But how those DNA differences may manifest depends on other features. For example, what your diet is, what your environment is, if you're a smoker. Sometimes how DNA differences affect a person are also influenced by the context of the rest of their DNA differences. So what this means is that it's challenging to look at a single DNA difference from one person to another and predict with 100% certainty what that will mean for the person. We don't have the full knowledge to do that, and we also don't even have the full potential to do that without knowing a lot of other information. So what does this mean for customers who get these results back? What it means is that the results, certainly for health related traits, for example, a 23andMe, it means that the results are often given in probabilities. You have a 30% higher chance of getting Parkinson's if you have this DNA difference. But the baseline chance is very, very, very small. So this is challenging for people to understand and to wrap their heads around without a genetic counselor. It can be very disconcerting, especially to have that ambiguity in probabilities, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and certainly, too, that when you look at ancestry itself, many more Europeans are represented in these DNA databases.
That this is an excellent point, and that is that we don't have an equal representation of genetic information from different, what we scientists say, populations. So African Americans, people of African descent, people of Asian descent, Native Americans. The more data that we acquire or can share from people of different ancestries, the more we learn. That's both true about, genealogy, but also medicine. It's a big push for scientists to try to make sure there is equal representation of knowledge, of genetic information for people of different ancestry. But your point is exactly true, that we have more power and more knowledge to identify features from Caucasians because they've overrepresented our databases.
Talking with Audrey Gash and Jill Slate. Audrey is a genetics professor at UW-Madison. Jill Slate, a legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. Your thoughts, your questions as well about at-home genetic testing. We're at 800-642-1234. Back after a news update. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. We're at the intersection of privacy and at-home genetic testing here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Major testing companies have this opt-in system where customers agree to allow the company to share their genetic information with third parties. Now, Ancestry, 23andMe, and Helix, they've all launched this coalition for genetic data protection last year, and their goal is to establish best practices for the industry and to propose recommendations to Congress. If you've taken a genetic testing kit, did you consent to third parties taking your genetic information, or are you not sure? Are you someone who's against taking these at-home genetic tests? We're at 800-642-1234. We have Jill Slate. She's a legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau, and Audrey Gash is here. She's a professor of genetics at UW-Madison. Let's go back to the phones now. Katie is joining us from Superior. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
What would you...
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
I was going to say, so I'm actually a cardiologist, and I deal with a lot of patients with high cholesterol and a genetic condition called familial hypercholesterolemia. And I was wanting to talk to you and have you speak to the differences between the SNP testing that you get with 23andMe and kind of the limited health information that they report, as opposed to the whole exome genome sequencing that you can get from Helix and Color and some of the other companies, and kind of how the, I don't think everybody is aware that there's differences. And just because 23andMe says you're not at risk of having high cholesterol doesn't mean you don't have one of the other variants that they didn't test for.
Right. Katie, thank you so much. Audrey, this is certainly going to send this one to you.
Certainly. Yeah, that's an excellent question. And maybe I can explain a little bit about the differences in the technologies that these companies and researchers are using. And so what 23andMe does is they will take the DNA sequence from a customer, but they're not reading all of the DNA sequence. They're really only looking at specific positions in the DNA sequence where we know there can be different versions of the sequence and where we know that those versions might be correlated with somebody's chance of getting a disorder or having a specific trait. And so their knowledge is not just their knowledge, but the DNA that they're looking at is limited by the information we already understand to some extent. I'm less familiar with the company Helix, but I can speak more, a little bit more about research efforts, including the All of Us study, which is a big study at NIH. UW-Madison in Wisconsin is a partner.
National Institutes of Health.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. We are a partner of the All of Us study. The goal there is to sequence all of the DNA of different individuals to track information about their traits, their development of disorders, their health over time. The goal there is strictly to help scientists and clinicians learn better how to interpret DNA differences that we can use for health. Very different goal than these direct-to-consumer companies. And so one of the challenges that we scientists and clinicians are trying to overcome is we don't understand what a lot of DNA differences mean from one person to the next. They may be impactful for health, for a person's traits, or they may not be. And so scientists are discovering how to interpret and understand that information. Companies like 23andMe are not sampling that information. So it is a very important point for people who are using companies like 23andMe to get medical information. They don't have the power to say that you are at no risk for getting a disease. What they tell you is that you don't have a DNA sequence version that we are looking for that's correlated with that disease. And that's important for people to understand also the limitation of these direct-to-consumer tests over time. They're not going to call you back in a year and say, oh, we discovered something, the important new disease version in your DNA.
Results.
But research programs like the All of Us program may do that.
Katie, I understand that you're doing research with the All of Us study.
So I'm actually one of the physician champions for the All of Us study at Essentia Health, which is based in Duluth, Minnesota. But we are also enrolling patients for the whole region in that study, and I agree. I think the more comprehensive approach is much more impactful for advancing research than the direct-to-consumer packages that you see on Facebook advertised.
Do you find, Katie, that they're going to reach the goal of sequencing a million or more people in the U.S.?
I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with education. We are definitely seeing an increase in enrollment. It's really just getting the word out and making, you know, really we need representation of all populations, and which is why we have a large Native American population in our area. And so we're trying to, you know, help oversample to be able to contribute to that million patients across the country.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for calling in. Jill, in your report, you talk about consumers who've taken a test and can publish their results on these open source genetic databases. What do they do? What does that mean?
So a customer of 23andMe, take, for example, the caller that we had a few moments ago. If she had tested her DNA through 23andMe and hadn't found any biological relatives, hadn't identified her birth parents, she might wonder, well, perhaps my relatives have used another service. How will I know, you know, if they use Ancestry DNA or if they use Family Tree DNA, if I have relatives out there? So what users sometimes do is download the computer machine readable description of their DNA and then upload it to a free or low-cost open-source website. The most popular one is called GEDmatch, so that it's kind of a meeting place for users of different services so that they can discover relatives regardless of what service sequenced their DNA. And those have come to prominence with the revelation that the arrest of the Golden State Killer in April 2018, I think. Mm-hmm. It occurred because law enforcement officers decided to take the same approach, to sequence crime scene evidence using the same method that the commercial genetic testing companies use, and then to submit a machine-readable file that represents the DNA up to GEDmatch and see if there are any relatives. And using that genealogical method, they identified a slate of different possible suspects and then narrowed them down using traditional genealogical methods. There's a variety of uses. It's a way for people to reach out and find relatives, but people have used it in different ways, basically.
Yeah, and the Golden State Killer, this suspect was charged last year with 26 counts of murder and kidnapping based on a DNA match, not for himself, but for a relative, which allowed investigators to hone in on the alleged perpetrator.
That's correct. And what's interesting, and I want to go back to something that you said, Audrey, is that one thing that you may have noticed with some of the recent arrests that have resulted from law enforcement use of GEDmatch is that they're often older middle-class white males, because that's a population that's quite well represented in the genetic testing databases and in GEDmatch. And it really, there's this interesting contrast between the overrepresentation of black and brown males in the law enforcement databases and the representation of white males in the these open source and commercial databases.
Talking with Jill Slate, a legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. Her new report is called Genetic Privacy in the Age of Commercial DNA Testing. Audrey Gash here as well. She's interim director of the Center for Genomic Science Innovation at UW-Madison. Your questions, your situations as well. Have you debated taking an at-home genetic testing kit? What questions do you have about them? Are you an attorney? What should people know about their rights after taking an at-home testing? Join in 800-642-1234. Audrey, as we talked about earlier, Congress passed the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, known as GINA, and that was back in 2008, prohibiting discrimination by employers or insurers based on their genetic data. But lawmakers have really had little guidance as to how DNA fits into the broader context of digital privacy. Is GINA comprehensive enough?
Is genetic information comprehensive? GINA.
GINA. Uh-huh.
I might have to ask Jillian what she thinks about this question. It's not my area of expertise. I think that one thing I will comment on is that scientists are still in the realm of discovering what we can learn about a de-identified genome sequence. So we had thought some years ago that without a name associated with a DNA sequence, you'd never be able to figure out what person that DNA came from. And now with only a little bit of extra information about that person, what region of the country they're in, what job they're in, what physician they or company they might have used, we can triangulate essentially. And it is possible, although challenging still, I think, to learn which person a given DNA sequence came from. Once you have that connection, then it is not hard for scientists or someone who's trained to be able to associate different genetic variants or differences with that person. And so so one of the problems, I think, as not an expert in legislation, one of the challenges is that scientists are still figuring out what the power of this data is. And so I think that that is an argument for close communication between scientists and legislatures and representation of scientists in our government and policy.
And some states have taken the approach. Oregon, for a long time, has had a government entity that advises their legislature on matters related to genetics so that they have all the information they need to determine, you know, do we need protections against discrimination that go beyond what's under federal law? Do we need them in housing and education rather than just health insurance and employment? So that's one approach that some states are taking, having an advisory board on this issue to connect scientists and legislators.
Talking about genetic laws, privacy, Jill Slate, legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau, and Audrey Gash here, UW-Madison genetics professor. You can join in. Do you work in genetic research? How does DNA databases, how do they help your research? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking at privacy concerns around at-home genetic testing kits and what the future holds for more oversight in this area. It's been over a decade since Congress passed the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. So what legal parameters would you like to see around genetic information? Would you like this treated like medical data? What does the future hold for your DNA? Join in 800-642-1234. Still time for you. Audrey Gash is interim director of the Center for Genomic Science Innovation at UW-Madison, and Jill Slate is a legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. Jill, you were mentioning there Oregon having an oversight board to help lawmakers in this really tricky area. How can states be more proactive on this type of legislation and what is really in front of them with these at-home genetic testing kits and the parameters around privacy?
Right. So Oregon is one sort of it's the exception to the rule in that it's a proactive decision to get scientists involved in the policymaking process around genetic testing. In many cases, legislatures are reactive when it comes to new technologies and only begin to contemplate their implications after they're very widespread. So what legislatures will likely consider over the next decade are whether to define commercial genetic testing companies in statutes. In Wisconsin, they are not defined in statutes. To define those entities, to create standards of transparency about the kind of information that those companies have to provide about where their data goes, how it's encrypted, how it's de-identified, whether to broaden anti-discrimination provisions under federal law to encompass provisions related to housing and education, and whether more broadly to define ownership over DNA. Do you have a right to demand that a company to which you've provided your DNA in spit form, do you have a right to demand that that's destroyed, that any record, whether de-identified or not, of your DNA is eliminated? Those are some of the questions that we'll see legislatures address in the coming decade, I'm sure.
Audrey, what excites you at this moment as a genetics professor, and what are you keeping your eye on?
What I think is really exciting right now is the potential that we have to learn more about how DNA genome sequences encode information that our cells use every moment of their lives to determine how cells and bodies function. And so there's a lot that we scientists don't know about how differences in DNA are read by the cell and what it means for the cell. But in this age, this research age of having access to these genome sequences, there's a lot of power in numbers in terms of the science. And so by having a lot of different sequences, we can begin to understand more about how biology works. Maybe I want to quick add something for your listeners. We've been talking a lot about privacy and privacy risks with these direct-to-consumer companies and open access databases. But in a research setting, like, for example, the All of Us program, there are very strict regulations that scientists commit to in terms of sharing data, associating a person's name with that data. And so that I want to make clear for listeners, that's a different realm. We still think a lot about patient privacy, but there are not the same concerns about if somebody is interested in signing up for the All of Us program to contribute their DNA and contribute to our learning about health and genome sequence. There is a different type of risk associated with their DNA sequence getting out in the world.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, both of you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Audrey Gash is a professor of genetics at UW-Madison, where she researches genetics and medical genetics. Jill Slate is a legislative analyst with the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. She recently published a report called Genetic Privacy in the Age of Commercial DNA Testing. And you can find a link to her report. It's over on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about encountering a stranger on a snowy road.
Driving home on a snowy Wisconsin night, author Crystal Chan and her mother encountered a hitchhiker in the blowing snow. The question of whether to pick him up or not led her to explore the meaning and limits of compassion. She brings us the story.
It was a bad snowstorm. the kind that wipes out your vision, erases the world, and makes you brake for a red light a full city block before you come to the intersection. It was nighttime, and my mom and I were in the car heading home over the viaduct on 20th Avenue in Oshkosh. The radio was off as my mom handled the vehicle on the heavy, slippery roads. That was when we saw him, a figure, hunched over, walking on the sidewalk on that viaduct in full blast of the winter storm. In fact, because of the storm, we almost didn't see him. What could he possibly be doing in a storm like this? I asked my mom. I don't know, she said. He trudged along. We inched along. Mom paused. Should we pick him up? I was surprised at her question. There are dangers out there, murderers and rapists and thieves. There we were, two women in a car in a snowstorm, the heater blazing. There he was, a young man, hunched over into the blinding winds, almost disappeared from view. You couldn't help but feel for him. I'd never picked up anyone before. I had a good hunch that my mom hadn't either. Yeah, I said. Let's pick him up. I rolled down my window. Hey, where are you going? I asked. He told us. The location was halfway across town. In the darkness, I looked at Mom and she looked at me. I looked back at him. Come on in if you want, I said. We'll take you there. We rolled to a slow stop and he opened the door to the back seat. A blast of cold air followed him in. We asked him some general questions, but he didn't say much, so we crawled through town in silence. I was sweating under my winter coat. He is in our car, I thought. I cannot believe we actually picked up a stranger. Mom gripped the steering wheel with both hands. The man spoke only to give us directions to the house, and when we pulled alongside it, he thanked us twice, then got out. As soon as he left, it was as if a sudden storm had lifted, even though it was still snowing. We turned around and crawled our slow way home, both deeply shaken, both deeply pleased. It's easy to say that compassion is a good thing. It's much harder to live it out, especially when you need to weigh things like risk and danger and fear. Mom and I both agreed that had we been the only one in the car, we would have kept driving. If there had been two men walking, we would have kept driving. And so forth. There are no easy answers, and I've messed up this equation more times than I'd like, preferring the route of safety to the route of lived-out compassion. But in extending that gesture of decency, somehow I felt more human in the process, more connected, less alone. It can be mysterious how compassion works, and how the strangest gifts can come in the strangest packaging in a snowstorm on a cold winter night.
Crystal Chan is a storyteller and author based in Chicago. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is The Morning Show. Join us Monday at noon on the Ideas Network for Wisconsin's 40th annual tribute and ceremony honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's hosted by Dr. Jonathan Overby. The program includes music from the MLK Women's Mass Choir, Fall Gospel Fest Choir, and Sista Strings with guest speaker Dr. Ollie Watts Davis. That's Monday at noon for a live broadcast and celebration right here on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.